I was going to give you the questions to answer.
Well, I suppose I better do it myself. Okay, you can go. Okay, out of harm's way. Okay, here we go. Yeah. Very good. So the first question for tonight. I am a beginner. Say with me. Often I have many monks say, look within you. What exactly am I supposed to do to look within me? Well, I know that sometimes that's what you say when you go to the doctors. Say, have a look inside. My thought pattern, let go of mind to free from thoughts, is a detachment process to make my mind lighter, to see, be enlightened. Thank you for taking time to answer my questions. Yeah, sometimes I say to look within, but what does that really mean? What it can mean, one answer, which I will talk about in greater depth later on. We have over there and over here the lotus flower, which is a symbol of Buddhism for a long time, except for the lotus racing car. That's nothing to do with Buddhism, because we go slowly. So, but anyway, the lotus, symbol of Buddhism, why? You may all know the simile from Vajrayana of the thousand pet, the Om Mani Padme Hum, and Om and Hum are just like a namo. It's like an object of a word of like worship, respect. But the two main words, Mani Padme, which means the jewel in the heart of the lotus, the Padme locative. So what does that mean? So like worshipping the jewel in the heart of the lotus. So first of all, what is the lotus? And then later on we'll come to the jewel. You are the lotus, your body and mind. So look within your body and mind to find the jewel inside. So how do you look within? Number one, you don't look over there in the books, on the internet, in the emails. The only thing you'll ever find there is trouble. But looking within oneself, first of all, you look right here in this body and mind, number one. So how do you look inside that body and mind? Just like the lotus flower. In the morning when it's all closed up and the sun shines on that lotus with the light and the warmth from the sun, the lotus slowly opens and you find out what's inside. And at first, the first layer of petals on the lotus, no, that's inside the outermost petal, is, you know, not bad, but it's still thick, hasn't got much fragrance. It's pretty, but it's not really gorgeous. Just as you start to open and look within, it starts to get interesting. And how do you open it up? Mindfulness and wisdom. Sorry, mindfulness and kindness. Mindfulness represents the light of the sun, or rather the light of the sun represents mindfulness, and its warmth represents kindness. Awareness and kindness, the light and the warmth of the sun, opens up the lotus. So inside the first level of the lotus is your mind. The outer level, the body, that has to protect the mind. Just like the outermost petal of the lotus protects the inside from all the warmth, all the dust and the bird poo and everything else, which is the outermost petal. I'm just changing because every time I just make it slightly different, so you're not just hearing what you've already heard before. So you get this mind. And what do you mean by the mind? First of all, is just how peaceful are you or how agitated? You start to look at the mind. And you go inside the mind. What do you mean by going inside the mind? First of all, you go inside time. Inside into the present moment, right now. That's going inside time. From all the endless past, all the endless future, you go into the middle, like focusing into time, into now. And right here, you focus in into the middle of now. And in the middle of the now, you know what you find? Thought stops. All the planning stops. Because to think, to plan, as I mentioned yesterday, to want something, you have to have a destination for your thoughts. I'm going to do this after I finish this talk. I'm going to have a cup of tea. Then I'm going to have a bit of a walk. And I'm going to brush my teeth. Then I'm going to... You have a plans. Or sometimes with thinking, you have the past. Oh, this morning he said this. This morning they did that. This yesterday they did something else. Imagine just you go right in the center of time. There's nothing much to think about. Sometimes I wonder when you see newspapers. The New York Times. It's not the New York Times, it's the New York Old. It's all about old stuff. Or sometimes they do have, every now and again, the horoscope, the New York Futures. I don't mean the futures exchange in the Wall Street. But do you believe in horoscopes? Once, many years ago, one of the people who comes here, it was my birthday. What do you get for a monk who wants for nothing? Something special. And he was a lawyer before, and he was very, very innovative. So without even really letting me know what he was doing, when he asked me, about what time of the day were you born on August the 7th, 51? It was about 5 p.m. or something. According to my mother, I can't remember it, but that's what she said. So he got one of these really expensive, horoscope readers. What are they called again? They're astrologers, yes. I was going to say astronauts, but that wasn't astronauts. Something to do with astronauts, astrologers. And so this astrologer made a really big, detailed horoscope for me. And on my birthday, he said, Ajahn Brahm, in front of all the people coming for that day, he said, I hereby offer you your horoscope for the next 12 months. It cost me a lot of money, and from one of the top astrologers. I want to read, like the executive summary, the first paragraph or two. And he said, it cost me a lot of money, but I think you need to read this, or at least to hear it. And everyone else needs to hear it too. He said, for anyone who was born at that time on August the 5th, 1951, this year, all of the planets and the stars are in alignment for me to say with confidence that this year, for you, Ajahn Brahm, will be a very good year for romance. That's what he said. Cracked me up. Everyone else was laughing. And he was wrong. I'm still a monk, so I don't believe in those horoscopes anymore. But anyway, so you go into the present moment, and in the present moment, you're going inside. And inside the present moment, it's silent. And you go further inside. And inside the silence, I'll mention this in more detail later on, you find you're breathing. Naturally, because there's nothing else happening. And inside your breath, you keep going, so what's inside the breath? You find what we call like the delightful breath. Joyful. A natural source of happiness for you. Enjoy this meditation. This is fun. And inside the joyful breath, you find this amazing, what we call the nimittas, the beautiful lights. And inside the lights, you ain't seen nothing yet. You've seen these great jhanas. Amazing things. And that's only the first jhana, and already blissing out. And inside the first jhana is the second jhana. Everyone's gone quiet now, paying attention. Whenever I mention jhanas, the really interesting stuff, they always, yeah. You know why? I won. And inside the first John is the second, inside the second is the third, inside the third is the fourth, you keep going on till you go right to the very, very center. You know what's really right in the center of the thousand petal lotus? The amazing jewel inside the very middle of you. You know what's there? I'm not telling you. It's nothing. Nothing. Do you believe me? No, all that hard work and there's nothing there. But anyway, that's why people don't believe you. Anyway, that's how you look within you. You go in and in and in and in and in. Deeper inside. See what's in the center. The one nice thing, which I will guarantee for you, when you start looking inside or finding out, it gets more and more beautiful. More happy. That's the weird thing, which I never expected. I actually should have done, because Ajahn Chah and all these teachers were telling you. But the more you go inside a lotus, the more beautiful it gets. And just the more fragrant is the scent of the lotus. The more delicate and amazing are those petals. You keep going in. The really beautiful, juicy stuff is right in the center. So it's really a happy path. A wonderful thing to do. Are you actually saying I'll get a better result in the future from just being here than if I think and plan things out? Won't more things go wrong because I don't control life to make it go right? And then I'll get in trouble when things go wrong, which will stress me out. Are you willing to take responsibility for the punishments and stress I'll suffer in the future because of this? Kindly, yeah, of course. Look, I've been around long enough. If I plan for the future, plan it all out, what I'm going to do this way, that way. Things go wrong. They go wrong anyway. If I don't plan it out, they still go wrong. The only difference is you plan, it goes wrong. You don't plan, it goes wrong. The only difference is that before it goes wrong, you can enjoy yourself and have a bit of peace and quiet. So just enjoy your life before it goes wrong. People have all these plans, and by the time they find out that they spend all their life planning. Even the great British philosopher. I love philosophy. And this is the great British philosopher, which I'm sure all of you know, even if you haven't gone to university. He was actually John Lennon. Life is what happens when you're busy planning something else. Or thinking about something else, I think he said, but it's close enough. Life is what happens when you're busy planning something else. You're planning, worrying, anxious, and then what happens is you're old. Where's life gone? All those planning. And did it ever work out the way you expected? Your life? If I look at me, no way did I ever plan when I ordained as a monk to be sitting up here and talking to people, having my photograph taken, and just going on, what was I saying the other day? Just going on Garuda Airways from Perth over to Bali. I was going from there to Yogyakarta for a conference. And as soon as I got to my seat, had a nice window seat, just looking after myself, just in economy, just relaxing. And one of the flight attendants came, she's in the aisle, and she turned around and looked at me and said, "Are you Ajahn Brahm?" I said, "I think so." Conventionally speaking. And then she put her hand on her heart and said, I must be your biggest fan. I've read all your books." And because people were watching, I didn't know whether to be embarrassed or just play along with this. And so, "Oh, really? Yeah, very good." And there was a couple of Australians sitting next to me, and he got out of his little travel bag, the basic method of meditation. He said, "Yeah, I take this around everywhere." I was really sort of quite stunned. I said, "Oh, yeah." But at least I knew that I'd get really good in-flight service on that flight. Whatever I asked for, I would get. But then what happened was, you know, after they served the meal, and they just and things got a little bit quiet, except for the Aussies, you know, so Australia flight from Perth to go to Bali, asking for their Bintang beers. You know, they had lots of those, all for free. And anyway, so one of the flight attendants, and just a bit of lull in the service, oh, the one who gushed over me. So he said, oh, can you please come to the galley? Okay. You know, just didn't know what to expect. And the in-flight service had been suspended for a few minutes, while every one of the flight attendants, including the senior flight attendant, were lined up for photo shoot. This is crazy! And so, one after the other took a photo. And then, in the galley, they had all these little buttons when somebody was asking for the service, and they go, ding, 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 ding. Because one of the Australians had run out of beer, and they wanted another top-up. But instead, they're having photos with me. So when I walked back to my seat, which was in the back of the plane, they were giving me really bad stares. That's not the sort of life I planned when I became a monk. You don't know what's going to happen next in life. So that's, you know, just whatever happens, happens. So you don't plan so much. Things will go wrong anyway. So you just, when you don't have so much, many plans, you can actually just tend to bend, you know, with the different circumstances of life as they occur. You don't have, I'm not supposed to do this, I'm going to just meditate. You know, you're not going to get me to go out and have my photograph taken. I never became a monk to do things like that. That's not part of my plans. I've got other things to do. You see, that's not a life I would like to live. You never know what's going to happen next and see what happens. And that's it. So, yeah, you will get a better result in the future when you understand that life is uncertain. You never know what's going to happen next. So enjoy this moment. In the next moment, wait and see. Who knows? Can you please teach us special technique to use to disengage from past, future, and thinking to be fully aware of the present moment? Yeah, you can use dementia encouragement. Let go of past, of future, and thinking. You can have a brain, take your brain out. Got a lobotomy, that's what you think of. Don't do that. You know, I do tell funny stories, so don't sort of quote me on this. Ajahn Brahm teaches, we have a lobotomy. No. To take away the past, future, and thinking, to be fully aware of the present moment. Is one of those is that little simile of the shopping bags. You've all been shopping except for me. I don't go shopping. Actually, some of the other monks go shopping in Bunnings. I don't mind sort of letting people know this. Burr's not here. Some of the monks, we've got a second monastery now, or we've sent sort of Ajahn Santuti, you know, the Vietnamese, very lovely monk, over to the monastery in Kelmscott. It's Cambodian monastery, but we don't worry about where people are at this. You know, it's almost, I'm the spiritual director. They made me spiritual director there recently. So I sent some of my monks over there. And that some of the monks were getting some stuff for the monastery in Bunnings, a hardware store. And who would they meet there? Ajahn Santuti, who was also doing his shopping there. For the monastery. He has his little Bunnings card, so it doesn't have any money because it's actually good value for money, monks, because, you know, we do all the work. You know, people give the donations and you get free labour when you get monks. So it's really a good deal for the bang for the buck. And I always tell you, Ajahn Santuti, to praise him, that the story of Jhana Grove, especially this bamboo floor on this side, what always happens, every time this happens, is you ask the builders, when is it going to be finished? And it's always going to be finished, sort of, I think, it was supposed to be finished in January. And said, okay, let's just have a little bit of spare time just in case. So we had the opening ceremony on Easter, which was going to be in April. And of course, after a while, they thought, January, that's pushing it a bit hard, maybe February. Oh, but we'll be finished in March. And when it got closer, they were really pushing it to finish it in April for our Easter retreat. So what happened, of course, in the afternoon, still hadn't finished. And especially the one thing which was really sticking out, the floor had not been laid yet. That side had was this big space in the middle. 6 or 7 o'clock, every builder went home. We're going to have the big opening ceremony the following morning and start our retreat. How many else other people were here at the time? Oh, really? Oh, you were there. Yeah, great fun, wasn't it? And so there, so 6 or 7 o'clock in the evening, builders went home. Big concrete hole in the centre here. So, the monks came to the rescue. And Bamadi, I think he was really involved in it too. And they worked about 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning to finish it off in the last little corner. And they were still up for the ceremony the following day. And they finished it off. And it's amazing. So, in this side here, the little brown bamboo floor which you're sitting on was laid by the monks in the middle of the night to get it ready for the ceremony. That's wonderful. So, you know, we do whatever we can. So anyway, that's why what you're sitting on there, and it's really inspiring. You don't just buy stuff and get builders to do stuff. You know, we're part of it. We own the project. It's part of us, which is wonderful. And when people sometimes say, I've heard this, people write this in books, and it's totally wrong. They say that in all of the history of Buddhism, no blood has ever been shed, you know, for the purpose of Buddhism. And that is wrong. I have hit my finger many times with a hammer. I have cut it many times. I used to say every building in Bodhinyana Monastery has got my blood on it. Because in building, and sometimes you make mistakes. Well, that's good blood. It doesn't harm anybody else. Anyway, could you please relate your understanding of Dhamma Veda and Atta Veda and explain why these terms are rendered as inspiration? Okay, this is a technical point, but it's a good point to understand the Dhamma and Veda. The Dhamma and the Atta. This is like phenomena, or this experience of this moment right now. Actually, I never got through to the shopping, did I? I'll do the shopping afterwards. About the shopping symbols, let go of past and future. That when you look at this moment, you look where it came from, why, what caused this? If it's like your tiredness, your happiness, your health, your sickness, the heat, the cold, the climate change, or whatever it is, looking back to these causes is looking for the Dhamma. The Dhamma is actually the cause, the rules, like the laws of physics, the laws of medicine, the laws of anything, which shows you how things work, where they come from. Because if you understand the rules, the laws, where it all comes from, it gives you an idea of how things evolve and turn out later on, which is the Atta. The Dhamma is like the causes, the Atta is the consequences, how it all figures out in the future. So that's why this hall, you know, where it came from, lots of donations, lots of hard work by the monks as well, that's where it came from. And where does it lead to? You know, it leads to having a beautiful place where we can all meditate. And just to have some great teachings and to quietness, great facilities, so we can advance in our Dhamma practice. So the Dhamma and the Atta. Sometimes people know it's the Atta Katha, which is the commentaries. but it's actually how the Dhamma works out, where it leads to. And the Dhamma is actually where it comes from. And the Veda, the Dhamma Veda, the Veda is like getting the inspiration once you actually figure out why. Now, why are you restless? Why are you tired? Why are you struggling? Why are you suffering? You find out the cause of it. Where it comes from. When you see the cause, yeah, I get it now. I understand. It gives you so much inspiration to find out it's not your fault. You don't have to blame yourself. And it's just, you get great inspiration. Oh yeah, I get this. And the consequences of it, where it leads to. And where it leads to is this amazing sort of peace and happiness. And even if you're sick, you can still be happy. Even if things aren't going well in the world, what do you expect? This is life. So you can be happy even when you are, other people expect you to be suffering. It's easy enough to be happy when life goes along like a song. For the one worthwhile is the one who could smile when everything goes all wrong. It's an old poem a long time ago. And as you see that, the consequences of this. And once you get sort of a glimmer of that, it makes you just so inspired. You're really onto something which is not only meaningful, you find out why, but you know it leads to happiness and joy. Somehow, I don't know why other people couldn't figure this out, but when I was a young man deciding on where to actually to go to become a monk, and I literally did start looking around all the different teachers to find out the happy ones. No way was I going to ordain under a miserable teacher. I knew enough that if you're going to be wise, you know, you're supposed to be happy. You're supposed to be ending suffering, not making more suffering. So whenever I saw a miserable monk or a nun, sit up straight! Come on, meditate! Bing! Too lazy! And they got the Zen stick out. Wow! That didn't make any sense to me at all. There's something which you read, you understood. Kindness, compassion. Yeah, but that's only for weaklings. Real monks, real nuns. We don't go to sleep. We don't have breakfast. There's this monk once over in England. I won't tell you who it is. It wasn't that man, there was another monk there. And for the rains retreat, the 3 months retreat. It was only a small monastery. They didn't get that much support. But what he would do, there was about 3 or 4 monks there with him. He'd have this big, like, 10-meter bucket, you know, like they have, you know, for cleaning. And he would take it out of the fridge, the freezer, in the morning. It had yesterday's leftovers. And whatever new food was brought that day, no matter what it was, he put it in the top of the basket. With a big spoon, stir it all up. It would be heated up. Stir it all. Yesterday's leftovers and today's additions. And then he'd take, you know, put it in his bowl. He'd pass the rest down. You know, for every monk, they could take whatever they want. However much they want. And once they've taken theirs, and it was finished, then he would put it back in the refrigerator, the freezer, for the following day. And that's how we'd keep on going on. Do you think that's a good idea, Bianca, for some of us? It saved a lot of cooking, a lot of washing up as well. So they did that for 3 months. And at the end of the 3 months, all the monks left. They didn't want to come back to that. It was a bit too aesthetic for them. But anyway, that, you know, you don't need that. Sometimes you can see some of these monks were just so incredibly kind. And, you know, you took them as an example. When people were sick, they just took a rest and were looked after. And that was something which, the beautiful kindness, that's what inspired me. To see that these monks and nuns were just some of the kindest people I'd ever met. And it just blew me away with their kindness. I'll just mention good old Ajahn Tate was one of my favourite monks. He lived in Hinmukpeng on the banks of the Mekong River. And I had all these questions, like, you know, we all have questions we want answers for. I had many questions. I was a bit afraid of him because, you know, he could read minds, no doubt about that. And, you know, was I ready to have my mind read? Maybe he would tell all the others what I was really thinking. But anyway, I had all these questions and I had to wait in queue. When I went to enter into his room, you know the amazing thing which I'll never forget? Every question I ever had just evaporated. I couldn't formulate a question anymore. And instead, you were just really amazed by this wonderful, sort of over-empowering, just kindness. I didn't have to be perfect. With all my faults, it didn't matter. It was this incredible sense of I didn't need to improve. I didn't need to do anything else. All my questions were totally obliterated by that kindness. So he just sat there at peace. I was good enough. I didn't need to pass any more exams. I didn't need to impress anybody else. I didn't need to impress myself. It just totally was at ease and let go. And that was, you know, the other thing which I remembered, the thought came in my mind, right, that's it, I'm not leaving. They're going to have to drag me away with every water buffalo there is in that village, and I don't want to go. I'm staying here. I'm going to die right here. Because I didn't want to leave. It's just total acceptance. And what it showed you there is you don't have to improve. Except, you know, stop sort of, you know, looking down upon yourself. Just be at peace with yourself. So simple, but people just know, I'll improve first, and then I'll let go. So anyway, oh yeah, that's the Dhamma Ways and Utter Ways. It just really inspires you. Once you get inspiration, then you go and meditate. And it's so easy. Force your mind to meditate and it just doesn't want to engage. When you've got inspiration, wow, you're off. You sit down, the mind just takes over and you just get so peaceful, so joyful. Inspiration is one of the most wonderful ways of meditating. But anyway, back to the shopping bag simile. How to let go of the past and future. Imagine carrying two heavy shopping bags, one on the left hand, one on the right hand. One on the left hand, you look on the outside, it's got the words P-A-S, or the letters P-A-S-T written on the outside. It's your past. Within that shopping bag, it's not clothes, it's not food, it's not IT equipment. All it is actually this, you know, we've got too many iPads. You know, which the monks don't need anymore. Does anyone want an iPad? Free iPad? You need an iPad? You know what they are. They're eye shades, which I get from... that's what they say in the United States. Over here we call them eye shades. In the United States we call them iPads. You know, the little pads you put over the eyes, you know, to keep the light out. And so I went to one of the monks in the monastery and I said, oh, we got an iPad here. I said, oh, you know, what brand is it? Is it an Apple? Is it Samsung? It's Singapore Airlines, yeah, it's an iPad. You never let me forget that. Anyway, so you got your shopping bags. And on the left hand, he never took it, by the way. That's not the iPad he wanted. But in the left hand, you got the shopping bag full of the past. The right hand, a shopping bag full of the future. All your worries and concerns and plans. You know how heavy they are. You've carried shopping bags or you've carried your luggage, you know, through the airports and stuff. It's so heavy. You've been holding it for such a long time. It makes your arms ache and your shoulders hurt. So you do a visualization of that. Carrying these big heavy bags, your past and the future. Carrying them for a long time. Your heart aches, your mind is tired with all those worries. So what do? You in your imagination, you focus on the bag in the right and left hand, your past. How heavy is it? And you imagine leaning to the left, lowering the bag down until it meets the floor. When it meets the floor, all the weight is gone. All the burden of your past. The floor is holding that now. So you can move your hand away from that back, straighten up your spine. your left hand, an arm are taking a break, recovering. You've got the bag in your right hand, all the future. You lean to the right, lower the bag containing your future to the ground slowly. And when it meets the ground, there's no more burden. You unclench your fingers of your right hand, move up your arm to your side. And there you are, if you let go of the past and the future, is represented by those two heavy bags containing your past and future. And then, you haven't finished yet, as you are recovering, you look down at those two bags. No one is going to take them away. You don't have to worry about them, they're yours, they're going to be there afterwards. But in the meantime, you are standing between these two terrible burdens, the past and the future. You're standing in the present moment, right between the past and the future. You've let them go, and so you are taking some relaxation, some time out. And doing a little visualization like that helps. You do the real thing. As you visualize it, afterwards, yeah, you realize why you should let go of the past and future. Take a break. Why that no one's going to take it away, you don't have to worry about anything. And just how peaceful it is to be right between the past and the future in this present moment. Dear Ajahn, can we kindly request for you to teach us metta compassion tomorrow morning rather than on the last day so we can practice it? Obviously, whoever wrote this knows my little metta technique. So if you already know it, I don't need to teach it, so you just practice it. This is a nice way to end the retreat, so you can take these things back home with you. What you said about things being good enough was very helpful. But some conditions really are better than others for practicing. But, can I make a rule that there's no buts in these questions? Sometimes you get really good. Oh, things are so peaceful and so wonderful. But. Anyway, but some conditions really are better than others for practicing. And in daily life, you sometimes do need to make changes. So how do you know when it is good enough or when somebody needs to change? Okay, now it's good enough. You can change later. Except when you go on the bus or the train and they say, all change. And you say, Ajahn Brahm said no. I'm happy where I am. Then you get in trouble. In one of the talks, can you kindly explain dependent arising the 12 steps? Ah, when you get the number right, how many links are there in dependent origination? It's not 12. When you get the number right, then maybe I'll explain it. Because you have to be very smart. For example, listen carefully, I'll find out how smart you are. 30 cows in a field. Those of you who heard this, please be quiet. Listen carefully. 30 cows in a field. 28 chickens. How many did not? You see, you can't even answer that one. How can I explain dependent origination, which the Buddha told Amanda is very deep and profound? I'll say it again, see if someone can come up with the right answer who hasn't heard it before. 30 cows in a field, 28 chickens, how many did not? Have you heard it before? Okay, so maybe I can tell you dependent origination later on. But for the rest, shall I put them out of the misery? Okay. 30 chickens in a field. So no, that's right, I'll get it back again. I'm getting all confused again. 30 cows in a field. 28 chickens, how many did not eat chickens? Thirty cows in a field, 28 chickens. It's not 28, it's 20 consumed. They munched on chickens. Now, don't tell me what a cow's doing eating chickens. That's cow's business. Nothing to do with you. If a cow isn't a vegetarian, that's their choice, so leave them alone. 30 cows in a field, 28 consumed, munched on chickens. So how many did not eat chickens? It was 10, yeah, that's right. See, that's the right answer. So you have to be very smart to be able to understand the okay, dependent origination. I will do it, but it's takes a bit longer than just 10 minutes. So I'll do this another day, but I will do it there. Whenever I focus on my breath, I'm hearing high-frequency noise in my ear, like late-night insects chirping. Is it disturbed? It has disturbed my focus on the breath. What are they? Is it because I have a cold? No, it is insects. No, a lot of times, not insects chirping. What is happening? Focusing on your breath. You don't have to focus on your breath. The breath will come to you when the breath is ready. I said this morning, and it's very powerful, great little meditation method. Always go back to it, always works, no matter what's happening to you. Now is the most important time. The most important thing to meditate on is what's right in front of your mindfulness right now. So if it's a chirping, that is your meditation object. Don't try and get rid of it. Oh, this is chirping, this can't be right. No, be with it. It's here, it's right in the moment, and be kind to it. Embrace it. Be with it. And then that chirping will take you all the way to the deepest of meditations. The reason why we don't go to deep meditation, we want to change it. This can't be right. So fault finding, we go off to something else, something different. Similarly of that lotus, whatever it is, whatever stage of that lotus it is, you be with it. This is really important. You're aware, you're not trying to get rid of it, and you're kind, and it opens up. You go deeper into it. You find out what's in the middle of that chirping. I have noticed how my mind has a habitual fault-finding tendency. It always goes looking for the negatives in things. Do you have any advice on how to break this habit? How do you make it a habit to see the 998 good bricks? I've noticed my mind has a habitual fault-finding tendency. Stop finding fault with your fault-finding mind. Just be with your fault. You're fault-finding, so yeah, embrace it. Thank you. I've got a fault-finding mind. Isn't that wonderful? It always goes looking for the negatives in things. There you go, you're going off again. Do you have any advice on how to break? What are you trying to break the habit for? What's wrong with having a fault finding? Who said it's not illegal? It's not against your precepts? So when you embrace a fault finding mind, you don't find fault with it, then the fault finding mind stops. That's how it starts. You try and find fault with it, and it keeps on going on again. You're finding fault with the fault finding mind. Then you're finding fault with me encouraging you to embrace a fault-finding mind. And then you're finding fault with a fault-finding mind which finds the faults in the fault-finding mind, teaching of Ajahn Brahm and everybody else. And it just goes on and on and on. So, for you, got a fault-finding, yay! I got the fault-finding mind, yay! You know what happens next? You're not finding fault with your fault-finding mind, don't find fault with anything. Problem solved. Your thoughts on someone sharing and teaching the Dhamma with others before reaching a minimum of stream entry. So, what are they actually sharing? Are they sharing the teaching on the Dhamma, or are they sharing gobbledygook? Which one is it? But, it doesn't really matter that much. For you sharing your insights and understanding and as much as you know, which is fine. Because if we don't share a bit of Dhamma here, a bit of Dhamma there, then sometimes it never sort of gets us anywhere. So it's okay to share, but never think that you are right. There's an old saying which I saw, it's like a Mahayana teaching. The advice, now a young monk asked for some advice from his master. And the master said, no, quick advice. And the master said, never argue with an idiot. That was his advice. And the disciple said, that's not very compassionate. And the master said, yeah, I agree with that. So my thoughts on someone sharing the Dharma with others? Oh, I agree with that. So we've got to talk, might as well talk on our understanding of the Dharma and talk about other stuff. Can you please explain walking meditation in detail? Can't we do it in short? Do you know how to walk? It's easy then. Just start walking. And whatever you're aware of right now is the most important thing, just embrace it. See what happens. So simple. Why do we have to make things so complicated? So we've got the walking meditation hall. One over there, one over there, one over there. These are walking meditation halls inside this main hall here. So you're meditating, get a bit sore, so you can go and do some walking meditation in one of the halls. And you can see they've got red carpets for you. If you ever want to practice walking on the red carpet before you become famous, then those red carpets. She's always going to try it out on the red carpet. Oh, no, I thought you were going to red carpet for nuns. So we do that because it encourages people to stay on the carpet so they don't go on the hard concrete. So you start at one end and walk to the other end. Usually put your gaze 2 meters in front of you, not... No, too much, not too little, not to the left, not to the right. 2 meters in front of you, just a body length. And then it means you feel safe. You're not going to hit your head against the wall. Keep your eyes open. And when you get to the end, you turn around and you walk back again. And try and be as aware as you possibly can of how the feet move. So, say the right foot is moving. How does it actually move? Does it go straight up and then horizontal? And then down? Or does it go in sort of like a curve shape? Like my ones goes up and back a bit. Then it goes forward. Like in a curve. Then it goes down. And find out what part of the foot meets the ground first. And what meets it last. And how it feels when you touch the ground. It's always good to do without any shoe coverings or any socks. Actually to be able to feel the pressure, the contact between your feet and the very soft, the actual yoga mats, so that you can actually feel it, you get to be aware. If you don't like doing it here, you can do it around the stupa, walk around there. You can do it in so many different places around this complex. Find a nice place and just walk backwards and forwards, backwards and forwards. The nice thing about walking meditation, of course, you always end up where you started. You don't get anywhere, do you? So much of life is like that. Go around in circles. We never really get anywhere. We end up basically where we began. We start off with no teeth. We start off in life talking rubbish, if you can talk at all. We start off with nappies, we end with nappies. So this is our life. We go back to where we began. Start off in hospital, end up in hospital. So, that's for most of us. So that means, no, we're not getting anywhere. We're being here. We're feeling as much as possible, just the process of walking. No need to go fast or slow. Whatever sort of, speed which feels natural to you. Because, okay, all the walking meditation stories. When you're doing walking, you don't have to do it slowly or fast, whatever's natural. There seems to be a habit you have to do it slow. And real meditators, that you know them by the slowness. In fact, in some meditation centers, there's a competition. Who can walk the slowest in the walking meditation hall? And what happened once, there was a retreat here. And I did give permission for a little family just to have a quick look, but not to disturb the meditators. And they had this young 6-7-year-old kid who came back and had to see me. And he was very concerned. He said, "You've got to look out for your meditation center." I said, "What's wrong there?" He said, "It's been overtaken by what? By zombies." Because apparently, in zombie movies, the zombies move really slowly. So we call, forced slow walking meditation, zombie walking meditation. That's what they look like. Anyway, so just do it naturally, and that's fine. And the other story, this was, again, one of the first monasteries opened up in England. And this was actually in Sussex. This was an English village. And if you know all of the myths about English villages, they're not myths at all, they're absolutely true. They're so conservative, people are nosy, looking through the windows, finding out what's going on. And one of the big houses there, it was actually bought by a psychiatrist who was working in the local institution for those with mental health problems. And so, of course, everybody in the village knew that. And then one weekend, because the house was very big, she opened it up for a weekend meditation retreat. And when it got time for the walking meditation, all these meditators were in the garden, walking really slowly, and many of them wearing white. One of the old matriarchs of the village just happened to be looking through the window, opened up the lace curtains, and saw all these people in white uniforms walking really slowly. And of course, she added one and one up and made three. She called the police. She said, "This psychiatrist from the local hospital has brought her patients home for the weekend." And the police came in their car to arrest all these meditators and take them back to the happy home. And they had to explain, no, we're not crazy, we're just meditators. And they didn't understand what meditation was, so they took a lot of arguments actually to an explanation to actually not take them away. Same with me. I remember once just in first year here, there was this poor Nepalese man who had a epileptic fit. And so I was looking after him, make sure he didn't sort of choke, and called the ambulance. The ambulance came and saw the gentleman there. And then the first thing they asked him, he said, "What day of the week is it?" He didn't know. He just had an epileptic fit. And so they took him, without asking any more questions, put him in the back of the ambulance, take him to hospital. And that really scared me, because I was a monk living in the present moment. I didn't know the name of the week either. Don't watch TV. So from that time on, I always try to remember what day of the week is it? You can still live in the present moment. Every now and again, just check. It is a Saturday. Otherwise, something happens and they take you away. So anyway, okay. Thank you so much for being with us. That's walking meditation anyway. Thank you so much for being with us and teaching us on this retreat. I feel that we can't really fathom what an amazing opportunity this really is. Thank you. You haven't seen anything yet? Wait till the end. It gets much worse. But it gets better. Who knows? Imagine mind, when the mind is peaceful but the legs are so heavy, so numb, so painful, should we focus on peace or mind or part of the leg? I know. The mind is peaceful, the legs are so heavy, so now just stretch them out. You can actually just move, just change the posture. Even in the middle of the meditation, you're peaceful but they're heavy or they're painful. Just... only takes a couple of minutes. Less than that, actually. So yeah, it does disturb the meditation, but enduring the continual pain will disturb it more. So it's only a slight disturbance moving it, and then you soon get back to where you were, and then you can go deeper without the pain. It's okay to move during the meditation. And especially coughing. Thank you. Because you know what happens? Some people think, oh, I mustn't cough. Can't disturb people. And here we go again. And it's something which we call in meditation retreats the volcano effect. I've seen it many times. What happens? They don't cough, yeah. They bottle it up to say, I'm not going to disturb anybody. And so they hold it in. And just like a volcano, plugged up, the pressure builds and builds. It's going to blow. It builds and builds and builds. And when it does that, and all the monks over in Bodhinyana can hear it. All the prisoners up in Kana can hear it. I'm exaggerating, of course. But many people hear it. And worse. Just like all this toxic gases and boulders and wet stuff just goes around all the people around you. Really unhealthy, yucky. So if you're going to cough, just cough. It's only a short thing. So legs are so heavy, so numb, so painful. Should we focus on peace of mind or part of the leg? Move. Adjust. Thank you for your compassion and holding this retreat for us. When I meditate, I notice that my mind deviates from the present moment towards some particular topic. So I think this is because my mind is grasping to certain delusions. Can you explain, maybe with some examples, of how I can contemplate the topic using the five aggregates to disentangle my mind from these delusions? No. If the delusion comes up, it's teaching you something. So just stand a little bit back and just watch with kindness and see what happens. After a while, you find these delusions are a totally waste of time. So, similarly, when I do go traveling, always open to find nice little similes, you know, from your experience to understand what's happening in meditation in this world. And the experience which I remember, traveling through Changi Airport, Terminal 3 in Singapore. If you go to a flight from Gate A to Gate B, there's the A's and the B's, and you have to go through the middle of that Terminal 3, in which there is a sports lounge. And there you have this huge TV, usually showing EPL soccer. And you see all these men, invariably men, but don't worry, the girls are going to get it in a moment, in another simile. All these men watching the TV, the soccer, and getting so excited. Every now and again you see them jumping up. That was not offside, ref. That was a goal. And I see them standing up shouting. And I can't understand why. Number one, that was being played in Liverpool. Such a long way from Singapore, it doesn't matter how hard they shout, you cannot hear them in Liverpool from Singapore. And number two, that was a replay. It happened last week. But, you know, why do people do that? Why is it sometimes on the aircraft, you know, you get up and you see people just watching the movie. They're crying. Just like when I was a young man, the experience of taking all my friends and our girlfriends We took them out one evening to see the West Side Story. It was like based on Romeo and Juliet, a doomed romance between Tony and Maria, from the opposite ends of what was allowable. One was Puerto Rican, the other one I think Italian or something. And anyway, right in the end, you know, these things happened, and Tony just accidentally shot Maria's brother and killed him, and Maria's other brother had a gun, was looking for Tony to kill him. And Maria was trying to warn the love of her life, Tony, be careful. And she was looking all over the west side of New York, in the dark, in the rain, looking for the love of her life to warn him. And she finally saw him under a lamppost, in the rain, in the dark, in the misery of a poor part of New York. And before she could warn him, a shot rang out. Tony's brother had found him at the same time as his sister Maria. And Maria, she ran over to the love of her life. She held him in her arms as he was dying. And this was, I don't know, 1, 2 o'clock in the morning in New York, and somewhere there was an orchestra. And instead of calling for an ambulance, they started singing, "There's a place for us, somewhere, a place, a time for us, peace and quiet." I forget the words, but I think maybe you know that. And anyway, I don't want to sing them because, you know, and I don't break my precepts because no one in their right mind would call this singing. "There's a place for us." And then I looked at my girlfriend and the other girlfriend sitting there, and they were just crying and weeping. It was so sad. And boys being allowed to be insensitive in those days, we were laughing our heads off. So much for sympathy. I remember that. And we asked the girls, what are you crying for? "Oh, it's so sad. It's a movie. Oh, it's so sad." And they knew I was a Buddhist. So I told them, "Look, if you want to find out about reincarnation, just wait for another 15 minutes and you'll find Tony will be reincarnated at the next showing of the movie." But, you know, jokes aside, what is the psychology of this? The psychology, if you're watching a movie like that, you get actually drawn in to the action. It's like you're part of the whole drama. That, you know, you are watching in some parts of New York and seeing what's unfolding, which is why you get emotionally entangled. When you're watching a football match or a cricket match, it may be a repeat, it may be on the other side of the world, but for you watching that football match, you are on the stands, watching it live. That's what it feels like. This is why you get excited, why you start cheering. You're part of it. That's what these things do, they draw you in. And if you want to actually find out what's happening, you watch these movies and then you stand back. So you realize, you make sure that you aren't part of the movie set. You're not in the cricket ground as it's happening. You realize you are watching from a distance. When you get that sense of physical detachment, you look at it from a distance. It takes away all of the entanglement. It's not as much fun. That's why some people like, they know what they're doing, they get involved just to get into it, have a bit of, a weepy, it's so sad. Or get excitement, yeah. But when you know what you're doing, you can be so peaceful. And that's exactly with all those thoughts and fantasies and dreams which go on in your mind. You get entangled in their importance. It's a plan which will never happen, a dream which will never occur, a past which is not quite as you thought it. But you get entangled in it and emotionally affected. You can just stand back from your thoughts, stand back from your memories, stand back from your projections of the future, and you realize they're so unreal. They don't draw you in anymore. But the problem is, then what will I do? I've got nothing to do to waste my time. Which is one of the reasons why people like dramas. If they haven't got one in their own life, they'll make one, they'll look for one on TV. They'll make one up. The end of the world. And Spider-Man. And Bhikkhuni Nun. Are there to save the world. People love that stuff. It's totally ridiculous. You know what's going to happen. I know what's going to happen in all the adventure movies. They get that close to the end of the world. But the very, very last minute. Very last minute, they save the world. Sometimes, you know what a plot is. There's always going to be something or other comes in, but they always save the world in the end. I've never seen any movie or heard of any movie where the world ends. Because if it does, there's no more movie. Anyway, what am I doing next? Okay. How do we meditate on earth, in water, or space, or time? If you want to meditate on earth, go and do some gardening or some raking or something. On water, just stand under the shower. Space. There's so much space here. Look, seriously, meditate on space. When you come in this room, what do you see? People and things. How about looking at the space between things? The space between the ceiling and the floor, between the walls, between the people, instead of the things. You'll notice there's more space in this room than there are people or things. It's a pretty empty room. But we never focus on the emptiness, the space between things. We only focus on the things. There's that meditator, there's that teddy bear, there's the Buddha over there, there's a nun over there. But you ever notice how much there isn't in this room? That's how to focus on space. On time, I have to focus on time because I'm running out. How to deal with restlessness and boredom when every 5 minutes seems like half an hour? Wow! If every 5 minutes is half an hour, you've got, what's that, 6 times as much time on this retreat than other people have. So other people have got only 9 days, you've got 5 minutes seems like half an hour, that's 9 days will feel like 54 days, almost like 2 months. Bianca, you have to charge them more. She doesn't do any charge. So look at the bright side of things. Wow, it's amazing. So restlessness and boredom. Just boredom especially. Have you ever actually investigated boredom? Really got into it and find out what it is? What does it feel like when you're bored? Is it a physical feeling? Can you actually feel it in your body? Find out, because most emotions are actually have a physical counterpart. When you're anxious, you feel tight inside. When you're angry, you're burning in your body. When you are bored, where do you feel it in the body? What is the feeling like? What does it feel like? Get to describe it. Do an investigation into boredom. And how long does it last? Now, when you first notice boredom, does it get sort of more intense? What does it mean by more intense? Is boredom just boredom? Has it got different levels of boredom? There's no ordinary boredom, and mega boredom, and just giga boredom, and just really going, you know, beyond the bounds of boredom. And, you know, we've never felt such intense boredom before. And what happens next? Does it stay like that? Or does it dissipate? Does it get so strong it cannot maintain itself any longer? And how long does it last? And how does it affect, you know, your sleep patterns? How does it affect your appetite? You know, and does it just appear in the morning or just at night time? You know, if it's like a sunny day or if it's an overcast day, is the boredom different? So do an in-depth, you know, boredom is very interesting. You can become an expert on boredom. In fact, in so many psychologists, they have so many sort of, they're very good at depression and anxiety. Imagine being an expert on boredom. That's a niche place for a therapist. which no one else has done before. So you can actually just go and make, write a bestseller book, get a PhD on boredom. You know, when it gets interesting, because you investigate it, there's no more boredom anymore. So anyway, that's how to overcome boredom. Then you get into it and find out about it. I appreciate your teaching, contentment, appreciation, we do need that as human beings. However, that's another word for but. What about the advice of don't settle and create a future for ourselves and loved ones? Oh my goodness, what are we creating for ourselves? Just a lot of people, a lot of resources, no time, a lot of craziness. How do you create, where is your future made? Now, this is where you're building up your future. So you can only do something for the future right now. So pay more attention to where your future is being made. And that's where you create for your loved ones and yourselves, by caring for the present moment where your future is being made. What's the likelihood of making a better life than what our parents had? Better life or worse life? Who knows? You can't really compare. But what you can compare is not really, you know, what you have or who you're with, but what you make of that. How you relate to it. So it's amazing. You can make something out of almost nothing. Have you ever seen these kids playing football with just a bunch of old clothes which they tie together? They have amazing games of soccer. How people just... Ah, it's something inspiring. There was this kids in Venezuela, and there was a big rubbish tip there, and they, from the rubbish tip, they made a band, an orchestra. Just what people have discarded. Drums were obviously easy, but they got sort of, you know, some other sort of bath, well, not bathtub, but some big box and put some strings over it to make a sort of banjo. And they got some, you know, other sort of tubes or something, old pipes, which they made a flute out of. And it was wonderful to see this rubbish band, you know, but they played really good music. And all made out of stuff which they got from a tip. And not stuff which they bought in a shop, and just what they can make out of discarded stuff. I think they were playing, I think it was some Mozart they were playing on this. And it was incredible to watch that. Wow, this is really cool. You know, just where there is that inventiveness, creativity, you can make incredible music out of what you find on the tip. Really good. So better life? Just doesn't matter, whatever you've got, you make use of. My mind is easily distracted by noises from surrounding environment. How can I deal with this during meditation? With earplugs? Thank you kindly. It's not the noise disturbs you, it's you who disturbs the noise. So, it's not distracted, just be with the noise. So it's just noise. Be with it, don't fight it. It's part of life. So if the noise comes up, it's the most important thing in the world, because it's happening right now. And be kind to it, instead of fighting it. Buddhists are supposed to be pacifist, so don't fight the noise. Thank you, noise, for coming to visit me. And you can hear these amazing noises. And, just like the story of that one monk, his brother came to visit, and, you know, there was no space to stay in the monastery. It was always full up, just like the nuns' ones, it was full. So, you know, it's a good sign that, you know, it's very popular, but it always does create headaches. And so I said, there's no place you can stay. The guest rooms are all full. This place was having a retreat. So, oh, it doesn't matter, you can stay in my little kuti. You know, monks have a room each called a kuti, and it's about 3 meters by 2.4. So it's a bit sort of, you know, cramped. He said, well, it's my brother, we grew up together, it's okay. So, oh, fair enough. But remember, you're getting old, and I'm sure that you snore, and I'm sure that your brother snores as well, you're about the same age. No, no worries, I've got my plan. What's your plan? Go to sleep first. And then his brother can't go to sleep. Not very compassionate, but he said it works. But it didn't happen the way he wanted it to. Because what should actually happened was his brother went to sleep first. And he snored like one of those jumbo jets. He snored so loud. And so, you know, this poor monk was thinking, oh, I'm not going to sleep tonight at all. Couldn't go to sleep at all because of the noise of his brother snoring. And so after about an hour of this, he decided, no, Ajahn Chah's teaching, not the noise disturbs you, you disturb the noise. What does that mean? And so he thought, I'm not going to disturb the noise, not trying to get rid of it. So he decided to change his perception of the noise. He was a European monk, so, you know, he was very sort of refined. He started to imagine that snoring was like the most modern cutting-edge musical composition. The sort when I sort of, you know, go past somewhere and hear this stuff, I think that, you know, this is not music. But, you know, sometimes it is music, and sometimes people don't pay a lot of money, and this is breaking all the boundaries of, you know, what harmony and pitch and melody is all about. It's actually making a statement against the modern limited ideas of what music truly is. And it was just such a sort of an amazing thing. He started to actually can see a very convoluted, but there was like a rhythm and a melody in that snoring. You know, it was, you know, it had a repetition. That gave it a beat. And in the end, after a few minutes contemplating this, it was actually really interesting. And it was very soothing. And he told me that's the last thing he remembered when he woke up in the morning. Just how beautiful his brother's snoring was. And that's a brilliant example of how we can get very negative at snoring. Why is he snoring? I shouldn't have done this. I have to work tomorrow morning. Why am I doing this? It shouldn't happen this way. Change one's perception. It is something very wonderful and beautiful. And then you find, because you're not fighting it, you relax and you have a good sleep. Tell Ajahn Brahm, can you spot an extreme winner outside your monastery? What are the symptoms? I feel like I am an extreme winner. Extreme winner? Don't even know what that is, let alone spot one. An extreme winner. Extreme winner? Oh, a stream winner. They go extreme. Oh, I'm going to use that again, extreme winner. A stream winner outside your monastery. What are our symptoms? What are those symptoms is that they never write questions like this. They just disappear. They are just not sort of... that's the best thing, that they, you can't see them. There's no ego, no self. They don't worry about being anything. Sitting outside today, eyes closed, doing nothing, opened my eyes and saw an animal. Small, but as I've been hoping to see a kangaroo, I thought, that could be one. Then it hopped away and I realized it was a rabbit. Haha. Perception is a deceiver. How can we avoid perceptual illusions, delusions in meditation? What do we have to guard for? Oh, sometimes if you're looking, if you want to see a kangaroo, because you want to see it, even the sound of a small thing, see, that must be a kangaroo. Or those of you who are frightened, I'm afraid of ghosts. Something drops on you. Ah! It's not, we have these little birds, the cockatoos, and they like dropping little gum nuts on people's roofs. It's not a ghost. But you know that sometimes that when those kangaroos, not so much here, but over in Bodhinyana Monastery, when they just walk past, sometimes when they walk past, they just do little hops, and it does actually sound like people walking. And a lot of times, we said, it really was a ghost. Or like this story of this poor Thai novice once. I was there at the time. It was a full moon day, and we were staying up all night, monks were giving talks. And it just happened that day there was a death in the village, so we did a cremation that day in Wat Nanachat, the same place where we were staying up all night. And the Thai people are just, especially the Thai little novices, they were terrified of ghosts. And because we were in the hall for the evening talk and the chanting, usually the little novice would sneak back. He thought we didn't notice him. He'd sneak back to go to sleep. You know, staying up all night meditating was for the big monks, not for the little novices. But that night, to get back to his hut to take a sleep, he had to go through the forest, maybe for about 5-10 minutes. And he didn't dare go through the forest, because that day there had been a fresh cremation, and he was terrified of the ghosts. And he didn't get sleepy because he really needed to go to the toilet. You know, and it was so hard just to keeping his bladder, which was exploding, keeping it closed. And the minutes went past, and he was crossing his legs, and he didn't want to go out because to go to the toilet meant going through the dark forest, and the ghosts were getting for sure. But then it got to the point he couldn't stand it any longer, so he got out and he ran to the toilet, you know, in the forest. And he closed the door, he made it, safely. And just the relief of just, you know, emptying his bladder. But as soon as he emptied his bladder, he heard something coming towards his toilet cubicle. He heard it very quickly, and he just froze. It was inside, it was locked. And it came to his cubicle, and then he saw it. Even though he didn't see it, because it was inside, he heard it. Scratching on the door, trying to get in. And he freaked out. He stayed in there all night until it got dark. And afterwards he told me, and told all the other monks, he said, "Look, I really heard it. I wasn't sort of hallucinating. The ghost came to me and it scratched on the..." Actually, you could actually see the scratch marks on the outside of the door. And there we said, "Yeah, I've seen that. That's the civet cat. There's little cats who live, you know, in the forest. And you see it very often because, you know, the squat toilets have in Asia, the water easily accessible for the animals in the bowl. He was just wanting to come inside for some water. He was thirsty. The little civet cat just wanted to come into us. I'm thirsty. Come on, hurry up." That was the truth of it, but the novice, "No way, the ghost almost got me." He left the next day. So sometimes it's the case that, you know, you're not scared. "How can I aspire to Samma Samadhi yet not want peaceful meditation, hey?" Okay, this is the way to get into the deep meditation of the jhanas. If you want it, you never get it, simply because wanting it just makes you too tight. Here we go. "Could you please help me here? Are you an honest person?" Very good. "Okay, I am now Samma Samadhi, stillness." Samadhi means stillness. "I'm now going to hold this glass of water perfectly still. Has it stopped moving yet?"
No.
"No. You know why I'm not mindful, am I? I'm looking the other way, so I'm now going to be mindful. Has it stopped moving yet?"
"No, still jiggling."
"Still jiggling, because I'm not focusing. I'm not concentrating. I'm not going to concentrate." "Has it stopped moving yet?"
"No."
It's actually worse, usually, when I concentrate.
It's gotten a bit worse.
Yeah. So, what should I do? Yes, let it go. Put it down. I haven't finished with it yet. Stop. Don't be rushing around. So I put it down and relax and let it go. How's that?
It's better. It's stopped.
There we go. That's how to achieve Samma Samadhi, stillness. And out of gratitude, can we have a round of applause for my assistant today? That's how we do Samma Samadhi. Thank you. Anyway, Ajahn Brahm, do you have any advice on how to not let severe tinnitus, ringing in the ears, get in the way of meditation. Incorporate it. Let it be your friend. If you can't beat them, join them. And so if you try and get rid of it, it just sometimes just gets worse. But if you just let it be and be kind to it, see its advantages, at least you don't fall asleep. No trouble with sloth and torpor. Can you please explain the difference between mental formations and mind consciousness in the five khandhas? Oh my goodness, at 9:30 in the evening. Mental formations are mostly formed by what? The will. So a lot of the times, the fourth khanda, sankhara, usually translate as will, and things which result from the will. Now that makes it very clear, and that is valid translation. Instead of mental formations, so instead, formed by the will, and the will itself, and consciousness. Those are the two main places where people assume they exist. Who decided to come here, this retreat? Did you have free will? Or did you have to come here? Of course you had to come here. Prove you're here. So what is the will? That will come up later on. And the consciousness. So what happens in meditation? Your will gets calmed down. It's called letting go of control. Being content. Easily satisfied. Which means you're not encouraging your will. The food is just all done for you. You got a little bit of choice, but not that much. Which means you find you're letting go. It also means your sense of self starts to diminish. You're just another meditator. That's all. So you tend to vanish and disappear. And as you vanish and disappear, when you let go of the will, just temporarily, don't get too worried, you'll find you get very still. And it's very cool being still, it's worth it. Subduing your will and control just long enough to get so still and peaceful. It's a will which stops you being peaceful. You get so that you bliss out. Wow, this is really good. Not having a will for a few minutes. And some of the things you find out, this will, which you always thought was important for you, is actually an enemy. Never lets you be still. Never lets you be content. There's always something else to achieve through your will. And so after a while, it vanishes. And after the will vanishes, then your consciousness starts to vanish too. It's not yours. What you once thought was your essence turns out to be just an illusion. Just a mirage. Just a fantasy. Not real. And I'll finish off with the story of the man crawling through the deserts of Africa. He was No water left, no food, no reception on any internet or anything. He was on his hands and knees, sunstroke, heatstroke, everything stroke. He was about to die. Who knows, he was losing his consciousness. Struggling, lost in the hot desert. And then on the horizon, he saw a shimmer on the horizon. And he thought, what is this? Must be just a mirage. And as the shimmer got closer to him, you know, he realized, maybe this isn't a mirage. It looks like there's something coming towards me. He said, oh, I'm losing it. It's the heat. It's the I haven't drank water for a long time. And as it came closer, he heard the sound of like these barking dogs. And he thought he was barking mad. There can't be dogs in the middle of... And on the back, he saw what looked like a sled with a gentleman in furs following it. He said, I'm crazy, this is the end of my life, I'm hallucinating. It's a mirage. And as it came really close, he could see very clear this was one of those Inuit Indians on a dog, we used to call them Eskimos, on a dog sled in full furs, and his six husky dogs barking. And when they came up and licked him, he realized this was real in the middle of the desert. And he said to this fur-clad Inuit elder, he said, thank you so much. I thought I was going to die. I've been lost in the desert for days. And the Inuit said, and you think you're lost. Okay, that's enough for tonight. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Okay. Very good. Have a nice night. See you in the morning. If you don't get lost.